like to thank Erstein too for making it possible for me to be here. Yeah, life without theory. I've written an abstract. I may as well start with that. This paper will discuss recent attempts to provide the genre of biography with a philosophical and theoretical foundation. It will attempt to show that such attempts are fundamentally misguided. Biography is, I will argue, a profoundly non-theoretical activity, and that precisely is why it is philosophically interesting. Instead of looking to philosophy to provide a theory of biography, we should, I maintain, look to biography to provide a crucially important example and model of what Wittgenstein called the kind of understanding that consists in seeing connections. A kind of understanding that stands in sharp contrast to the theoretical understanding provided by science, and that is, Wittgenstein maintained, what we as philosophers are or should be striving for. Okay, so introduction. To talk about biography as a philosophical genre is to raise two separate but related topics. One, the philosophy of biography, and two, the thought that biography might be regarded as, in some sense, a genre of philosophy. In what follows, I want to address both these questions. Indeed, I want to address each in relation to the other. For my view is that the sense in which biography might be regarded as a philosophical genre is best understood in connection with a particular view, Wittgenstein's, of the nature of philosophy. The kind of understanding that Wittgenstein regarded as the proper aim of philosophy, namely the kind that consists in seeing connections, is, I would maintain, exactly the kind that biography is well suited to provide. But to see this, to understand how biography can be regarded as an exemplar of philosophical understanding. Hello. Come in. To see how biography can be regarded as an exemplar of philosophical understanding in Wittgenstein's sense is to understand that biography is fundamentally and essentially, to its very fingertips as it were, a non-theoretical exercise. In the rapidly expanding body of academic literature on biography, this point is not only not fully understood, it is completely turned on its head. And as a result, two thickets have been created which need to be cleared before we can command a clear view of biography as a philosophical genre. These thickets are, one, the confusions that arise from the tendency to see biographies as if they were themselves theoretical texts, and two, the confusions that spring from misconceived demands for a theory of biography. I want to attempt the clearance of these thickets through the following fourfold strategy. First, I want to survey the scholarly but non-academic literature on biography that dominated discussion of the genre until the last 30 years or so, identifying its strengths, its weaknesses, and the forces that pull it in the direction of theory. Second, I want to look at the work of some notable biographers who have approached their task in a consciously theoretical way. Third, I want to examine some representative samples of the kind of theorising about biography that have been developed in the burgeoning academic literature on the subject of the last 30 years. And finally, I want to bring to bear on these issues a consideration of Wittgenstein's notion of philosophical understanding. All right, so first the survey of the what I'm calling the scholarly but non-academic literature, what I've called the pre-theoretical period from Dr. Johnson to Sidney Lee. Dr. Johnson's two famous essays on biography, the first for The Rambler, 1750, and the second for The Idler, in 1759, might justly be regarded as the foundation upon which the modern scholarly literature on biography was built. In them, Johnson set the agenda for the 250-year-long discussion that followed when he raised the following five issues. One, the place occupied by biography in relation to other literary genres and other areas of scholarship. A place Johnson locates halfway between history, with which it shares a concern with facts, and novel writing, with which it shares a concern for what Johnson calls the joys, sorrows, happiness, calamities, etc. of individuals. Okay, the second issue is the question of who exactly deserves to have a biography written of them, to which Johnson's answer is almost everyone. "I have often thought," said Johnson, "that there has rarely passed a life of which a judicious and faithful narrative would not be useful." He takes particular issue with those who hold that a writer is an inappropriate subject for a biography on the grounds that most writers leave lives of thought rather than of action. "There is no reason," Johnson says, "why a biography might not derive its interest, even its narrative drive, from the beliefs and opinions of its subject, rather than from his or her actions." Third issue, what details it is appropriate to include in a biography. On this question, Johnson does not offer a general principle, but gives some telling examples. He approves of Sallust telling us about the way Catiline walked. His walk was now quick and again slow. "Because this detail," says Johnson, "gives us an indication of a mind revolving something with violent commotion." But he ridicules Tickle for telling us about the irregularity of Addison's pulse. More generally, Johnson remarks that, quote, "more knowledge may be gained of a man's real character by a short conversation with one of his servants than from a formal and studied narrative, begun with his pedigree and ended with his funeral." The fourth issue is the moral responsibilities of the biographer towards A, the reputation of their subjects and the sensitivities of the subject's living friends and relations, B, the public, and C, the truth. Here, Johnson defends a fairly robust openness, deriding those who, quote, think it an act of piety to hide the faults or failings of their friends, and ending his Rambler article with the remark, if we owe regard to the memory of the dead, there is yet more respect to be paid to knowledge, to virtue, and to truth. And then finally, the fifth issue is the question of whether it is possible to know with certainty the inner life of another, to which Johnson's answer is no. "By conjecture only," Johnson writes in The Idler, "can one judge of another's motives or sentiments." And for that reason, he regards autobiography as potentially, at any rate, more accurate than biography. Quote, "The writer of his own life has at least the first qualification of a historian, namely, the knowledge of the truth." This last issue, issue five, is strikingly different to the other four. Whereas the others are specifically to do with biography, the last is concerned with a much broader question. How, if at all, can we know what other people are thinking and feeling? Johnson's answer to this question, that we cannot know another's motives or sentiments, but have to rely on conjecture, sits oddly with his answers to some of the other questions. If we cannot possibly have any knowledge of the sentiments of others, then how can biography fulfil its aim, as in issue one, of depicting factually the joys, sorrows, happiness and so on of individuals? And how is it possible to attain knowledge of a man's character, as Johnson's answer to question three suggests is possible, if no knowledge but only guesswork is available of his motives and sentiments? Johnson's answer to issue five has to be understood, I think, as a reflection, or perhaps better a symptom, of his commitment to the philosophy of language and mind expounded by John Locke in the essay concerning human understanding, a book well known to have had a deep influence on Johnson. In his History of Western Philosophy, Bertrand Russell famously observed that though Locke's philosophy committed him to the view that the mind could have knowledge only of its own ideas, Locke himself, unlike his empiricist successor Berkeley, had too much common sense to adhere rigorously and consistently to the obvious consequence of this view, namely that knowledge of other people and of the outside world is impossible. The obvious inconsistency between Johnson's answer to question five and his answers to the other four questions shows, I think, that he followed Locke in spirit as well as in doctrine. As we shall see later, the issues raised by question five have loomed large in recent discussions of biography. In the first 250 years after the publication of Johnson's articles, however, the philosophical question of whether it is or is not possible to know the motives or sentiments of others was largely neglected in favour of the other four questions, the ones more directly concerned with the genre of biography, its proper aims and methods. Johnson's answers to these questions constitute, in some sense, a philosophy of biography. And it would not, I think, be stretching a point too much to see in Boswell's Life of Johnson a biography written in conformity with this philosophy. Boswell himself emphasises this point when, in the opening few pages to his book, he quotes several times from Johnson's two essays on biography, in order to reassure the reader that his biography was Johnsonian in all possible ways. Most notably, this is what he lays most stress upon, in giving more respect to the truth than to the memory of the dead. However, though we have in Johnson's articles and in Boswell's biography an identifiable view of biography, its aims, its methods, and its value, it would, I think, be misleading to attribute to either Johnson or to Boswell a theory of biography. What then is a theory, and why do Johnson's reflections on biography not count as one? The question of what a theory is has received some attention recently among Wittgenstein scholars because of the renewed appreciation of the importance Wittgenstein attached to resisting the impulse to theorise in philosophy. And we may not advance any kind of theory, runs one of the most often quoted remarks in Investigations, number 109. There must not be anything hypothetical in our considerations. We must do away with all explanation, and description alone must take its place. Characteristically, however, Wittgenstein does not provide a definition of what he means by theory. The editors of the collection of essays Wittgenstein, Theory and the Arts, published in 2001, have attempted to fill this gap. Acknowledging that theories, quote, may come in many shapes and sizes, the editors, Allen and Turvey, claim that, quote, despite this variety, theories tend to possess two basic features. And this is still Allen and Turvey. First, they unify a range of apparently disparate, unconnected phenomena by postulating an underlying principle that these phenomena putatively have in common and that can explain their nature or behaviour. Second, the common underlying principle postulated by the theory, whether it takes the form of an entity, process, force, concept, or something else, is at least initially hidden from view. By a theory, we mean, in this volume, a form of explanation that possesses both of these features. End of quotation. Allen and Turvey would surely not claim that this identification of two features that theories, quote, tend to possess, constitutes a definition of the word theory that captures in all its multiplicity and variety everything that would be described as such in philosophy, science, the social sciences, the humanities, and ordinary life. Indeed, such an attempt to provide, so to speak, the essence of the concept theory would run directly counter both to the spirit of their collection and to Wittgenstein's philosophy of language. In his famous attack on essentialism, Investigation 66, Wittgenstein asks us to consider all the things we call games. Quote, what is common to them all? Don't say there must be something in common or they would not be called games, but look and see whether there is anything that is common to all. For if you look at them, you will not see something that is common to all, but similarities, relationships, and a whole series of them at that. I can think of no better expression to characterise these similarities than family resemblances, he says in the following paragraph. For the various resemblances between members of a family, build, feature, colour of eyes, gait, temperament, etc., overlap and crisscross in the same way. That's paragraph 67. Many concepts, such as game and, Wittgenstein emphasises in paragraph 67, number, are family resemblance concepts, concepts which have no single essence and for which the attempt to find necessary and sufficient criteria for their application is fruitless. Later in the book, Wittgenstein insists that though the word understanding is used to describe two very different things, the understanding that we get from a theory and the non-theoretical understanding, the understanding which consists in seeing connections that characterises our understanding of art, music, literature and each other. Despite that, we should regard both these things as part of the same concept. Has understanding two different meanings here? His interlocutor asks, to which Wittgenstein replies, I would rather say that these kinds of use of understanding make up its meaning, make up my concept of understanding. For I want to apply the word understanding to all this. That's paragraph 532. Well then, if we're happy to grant such heterogeneity to the concepts game, number and understanding, why not to the concept theory? Why should we not use the word to describe, for example, both Johnson's reflections on biography and Einstein's theory of relativity? Well, we could if we wanted to. But in the interest of philosophical clarity, and particularly from the point of view of understanding the nature of biography, it would, I think, be better to keep them apart. The two kinds of understanding that Wittgenstein is concerned to distinguish can, for all their differences, be regarded as two kinds of the same thing, two ways of understanding. And we can regard Johnson and Einstein as illustrative cases, both endeavouring in very different ways and in very different areas to understand their respective topics. But if we want to get clear about the differences between the ways in which they attempt to understand their subjects of inquiry, we would do better to reserve the word theory, I think, for the kinds of cases that pass the two criteria identified by Allen and Turvey. This would not restrict the word theory to science. As Allen and Turvey point out, their criteria would also license the use of the word to describe theories in, for example, literature, aesthetics, metaphysics, and the philosophy of language. The views on logical form and meaning that Wittgenstein had advanced in Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, for example, would count as theory on these criteria. Johnson's remarks on biography, however, would not. He is not attempting to identify and apply a hidden unifying principle to the various things that we call biography. In the contrast between explaining and describing, upon which Wittgenstein places so much importance, Johnson's remarks belong squarely on the side of description. In Johnson's articles on biography, he strikingly refuses to succumb to what Wittgenstein in the Blue Book describes as the craving for generality that is born out of, quote, our preoccupation with the method of science. Johnson refuses, for example, to offer a general answer to the question of what kind of details it is appropriate for a biographer to include, preferring instead to offer specific examples of details he considers telling and details he considers striking. For the first 250 years of its existence, the scholarly literature on biography, built upon Johnson's foundations, followed the master in this avoidance of theory, and for the most part, confined itself to the kind of questions that Johnson had raised. Until the Victorian period, however, contributions to this literature were few and far between. James L. Clifford, in his anthology Biographies and Art, Selected Criticism 1560 to 1960, can, though he shows signs of having scraped every barrel available to him, find fewer than 20 pre-Victorian pieces of writing that discuss biography, and of these, only a tiny handful, including Johnson's own essays, have any substance, influence, or importance. Though Victorian biography has, on the whole, received a bad press, commentary on the genre came alive during this period. The literary journals of the time published a steady stream of articles discussing the nature, limits, and ethics of biography, some of the more interesting of which have been reprinted in the collections edited by Clifford and Nadel and summarised in David Navarre's book, The Lines of Life, Theories of Biography. Rising to the provocation of that title, I would maintain that none of the Victorian writers whose articles are summarised in the book were offering theories of biography. None of them, that is, provide analyses that satisfy the criteria identified by Allen and Turvey. This is not to say that there were not lively debates or interesting differences of opinion among the Victorian writers. Margaret Oliphant and Edmund Goss, for example, both wrote articles entitled The Ethics of Biography, taking diametrically opposed views on the matter. While Oliphant argues that a biographer has a greater obligation to the good reputation of his or her subject than to the truth, so that if a biographer discovers things that would ruin the subject's reputation, the right thing to do, she argues, is to abandon the biography. Goss takes the view that the duty of the biographer is to be, quote, as indiscreet as possible. Neither, however, offers their view as the outcome of a general theory, either of ethics or of biography. Goss, indeed, emphasises that the theme of the ethics of biography is one that resists the formulation of general principles and laws because, quote, each individual instance needs a law unto itself. In The Custom of Biography, Edmund Goss emphasises the difficulty of writing good biography. And in a way that anticipates Lytton Strachey's often quoted preface to eminent Victorians, inveighs against the dreary biographies of the time, those, quote, two great solemn volumes with copious correspondence which follow the coffin as punctually as any of the other mute sympophantry attendants, that were produced out of a sense of duty by amateurs and relatives with no special gift for scholarship or writing. Writing a biography, Goss stresses, is an art. Quote, it should not be taken for granted that it requires no skill or tact or experience in its execution. On the contrary, there is no species of writing which requires the exercise of a finer sense of proportion, of a keener appreciation of the relative values of things and men, or of a deeper sense of literary responsibility. End of quote. This is an argument for experts and expertise, but it is assuredly neither a theory itself nor a call for theory. Indeed, it recalls Wittgenstein's remarks at the end of Investigations about the non-systematic, non-theoretical nature of the expertise that a person might have about the emotional lives of other people. This is from part two of the Investigations. Corrective prognoses will generally issue from the judgments of those with better knowledge of mankind. Can one learn this knowledge? Yes, some can. Not, however, by taking a course in it, but through experience. Can someone else be a man's teacher in this? Certainly. From time to time, he gives him the right tip. Leslie Stephen's often cited article Biography, published in 1893, shows a similar awareness of the essentially non-theoretical nature of biographical understanding. Speaking of the value of brevity and of direct quotation in a biography, Stephen writes, quote, "A little analysis of motive may be necessary here and there, but you must always remember that a single concrete fact or a saying in which a man has put his whole soul is worth pages of psychological analysis." The title of Sidney Lee's Principles of Biography, published in 1911, makes it sound more general and theoretical, but in truth it is not. Lee's principles turn out to be more like the tips discussed by Wittgenstein. For example, he speaks of a law of brevity, arguing, like Goss and Stephen before him, against the formless mass of Victorian biography. And yet he admits, he even stresses, that what he regards as the two best biographies in the English language, Boswell's Johnson and Lockhart's Scott, flout this law even more than the despised Victorian biographers. Lee's chief concern, however, is not to present laws and principles, but to argue for the autonomy of biography, insisting that it is not the handmaiden of moral instruction, history or science. Its purpose is not to use the lives of individuals to teach moral lessons, nor to place individuals in history, nor again to collect evidence for scientific theories, for example, the Galtonian genetics. Its purpose is, as he puts it, the truthful transmission of personality. In the Victorian period, then, biographers and their critics debated the literary qualities of the genre, the ethics applicable to it, and the methods used to research and write it. But they did not feel any need for a theory of it. This began to change in the post-Victorian period, when widespread and intense dissatisfaction with the way the genre had developed prompted both critics and practitioners of the genre to ask fundamental and far-reaching questions about it. Sidney Lee's view that biography had as its purpose the truthful transmission of personality was generally accepted. But people began to ask, does the standard Victorian biography, the two great solemn volumes with copious correspondence derided by Goss, accomplish this task? And if it does not, as many agree that it didn't, then what would succeed where it had failed? Where was it going wrong? How could one transmit personality truthfully? Is such a thing even possible? In this way, methodological questions about how biographies ought to be written led to quite general philosophical questions about the nature of truth, personality, and representation. Following Goss's lead, many commentators took the view that the Victorian biographies had failed in their endeavour to transmit personality because they had devoted too little attention to the art of biography. They had gathered the documents, presented the facts, but they did too little to interpret and shape those documents into an account of their subject that was intelligible, faithful, and convincing. In English Biography, an often overlooked history of the genre published in 1916, the American scholar Waldo H. Dunn illustrates the point by citing as an example Thomas More's Life of Byron, which Dunn describes as perhaps the most conspicuous failure of the century. Echoing Goss, Dunn writes, "In the two heavy folio volumes of this life, Byron lies buried under a mass of material." He goes on, "After reading the life of Byron, the reader realises too that he has a right to demand of the biographer an interpretation, an artistic production, that he should not be left to sit down before an undigested mass." End of quotation. In order to bring the material alive, in order to present not just an undigested mass of facts, but a personality, the biographer requires, Dunn argues, not only the diligence of the archivist, but also, at least some of, the skills of the novelist. That biography requires narrative skill, and that done well, it engages the reader in something like the way a novel does, were not new thoughts. Dr. Johnson had made both points in the 1750s. What was new in Dunn's work was an emphasis on the need, the obligation, of the biographer to shape his or her raw material, leading to the thought that biography is more accurately seen not as a mirror reflecting the truth about its subject, but rather, as Dunn puts it, a work of art, a created, a fictive thing. He does not mean by this that biography is fiction, and he insists that a biographer has no right to transgress the truth, but he insists, quote, "The line between truth and fiction in life, narrative, is perilously shadowy." On the question of whether it is possible to achieve the truthful transmission of personality that is the widely agreed aim of biography, Dunn's book ends on a sceptical note. He had earlier written that, quote, "An ideal biography would exhibit the external life of the subject, give a vivid picture of his character, and unfold the growth of his mind." And then had appeared to endorse Edmund Gosse's characterization of the true conception of biography as the faithful portrait of a soul in its adventures through life. But at the end of the book, Dunn writes, "One leaves the study of biography with a feeling of the intangibility of this soul stuff, which goes to the making of mind and spirit. One feels a hopelessness of ever really getting the heart of a man." Beginning then with a dissatisfaction with the unstructured and artless nature of Victorian biography, Dunn ends with considerations that seem to demand reflection, not only on the ethical and methodological issues that have dominated discussion of biography since Johnson's day, but also on more general philosophical questions about the nature of truth, fiction, personality and self. Questions which seem to raise the possibility, famously discussed by Virginia Woolf in her essay The New Biography, that considers the truthful transmission of personality, biography is in fact impossible. Okay, here's a section on the new biography. It was in reaction against the undigested mass of Victorian biographies that Lytton Strachey inaugurated what came quickly to be known as the new biography. By the time Virginia Woolf wrote her famous essay of that title, the phrase was already in common use. Where Victorian biographies were large and unstructured, the new biographies were brief and tightly focused. Where Victorian biographies were uncritical and reverential, the new biographies were ironic and irreverent. The manifesto of this new movement is provided in the preface to Lytton Strachey's Eminent Victorians, published in 1918, in which he makes a plea for the genre to rouse itself from its Victorian slumbers. The phrases from the preface that are most often quoted, however, would have sounded familiar to readers of Gosse and Dunn. Most notably, Strachey's characterisation of Victorian biographies as, quote, "two fat volumes with which it is our custom to commemorate the dead, with their ill-digested masses of material, their slipshod style, their tone of tedious panegyric, their lamentable lack of selection, of detachment and of design." Like Gosse, Strachey identifies the problem with Victorian biography as a neglect of what is, in fact, a subtle and difficult art, quote, "The most delicate and humane of all the branches of the art of writing has been relegated to the journeyman of letters." Strachey does not, however, suggest as a remedy the cultivation of the arts of the novelist. Rather, he identifies two duties of the biographer. The first is, quote, "a becoming brevity, a brevity that excludes everything that is redundant and nothing that is significant." The second is to, quote, "maintain his own freedom of spirit." Strachey says, "It is not the biographer's business to be complimentary. It is his business to lay bare the facts of the case, as he understands them." This is what I, Strachey, have aimed at in this book, to lay bare the facts of some cases as I understand them, dispassionately, impartially, and without ulterior intentions. The qualifications, "as he understands them" and "as I understand them," do nothing to weaken Strachey's commitment to a robust distinction between fact and fiction that is implied by his use of the expression "to lay bare the facts of the case." Strachey's concern with and insistence upon getting facts right indeed pervades his writing. In his introduction to Warren Hastings, he chastises Macaulay for the factual inaccuracies in his account of Warren Hastings' life. "The portrait is a masterpiece," Strachey acknowledges, "but it is a masterpiece of imagination and not of history. Under the clear light of impartial inquiry, the fascinating spectre which Macaulay conjured up vanishes into air, or rather, takes its place once and for all among the villains of romance." Even more vehemently does he chastise James Mill, upon whom Macaulay relied for his information. The qualities that make a historian, Strachey famously observed, are, quote, "a capacity for absorbing facts, a capacity for stating them, and a point of view." It is this last requirement of a good historian that sets Strachey's vision of biography apart from those of his predecessors. What, though, does Strachey mean by a point of view? Strachey notoriously never provides a definition of the term. But this, I think, does not betray a culpable equivocation or vagueness. The term is as precise as it needs to be. Rather, it reveals Strachey's awareness of what kind of notion it is. It is not the kind of concept which one can grasp through a strict definition. Like many concepts, one acquires it, and can only acquire it, from examples. And then, not by seeing what is common to all of them, but rather by seeing the series of overlapping and crisscrossing similarities and differences that constitute that particular set of family resemblances. Strachey's paradigm example of a historian with a point of view is Edward Gibbon, who he insists was a great artist. The emphasis here is on history as an art rather than a science, and in stressing the difference, Strachey gives hints as to what he thinks a point of view is. Quote, "It is obvious that history is not a science. It is obvious that history is not the accumulation of facts, but the relation of them. Only the pedantry of incomplete academic persons could have given birth to such a monstrous supposition. Facts relating to the past, when they are collected without art, are compilations. And compilations, no doubt, are useful, but they are no more history than butter, eggs, salt and herbs are an omelette." Gibbon's art, then, that's the end of the quotation. Gibbon's art, then, consists in bringing, quote, "order out of the enormous chaos of his subject, a truly stupendous achievement." As is revealed in his criticisms of Macaulay and Mill, Strachey considered it the duty of the historian to get the facts right. But that is not the historian's only duty. A really good historian can, by exercising what Wittgenstein calls the understanding that consists in seeing connections, reveal the relations between the facts, and by so doing, transform a compilation into a work of art. Having a point of view, then, is for Strachey important for two reasons. One, it prevents a biography from becoming the undigested mass of which Gosse and Dunn had complained, by providing the biographer with a basis for making decisions about what to include and what to leave out. And two, it enables the biographer to present to the reader not just a selection of facts and documents, but also an interpretation of that documentation, one that will enable the reader to make sense of the material and thus to understand the biographical subject. In emphasising the need for a point of view, however, Strachey was not abandoning or weakening the robust distinction between fact and fiction mentioned earlier. He was not, for example, arguing for any kind of relativism with regard to historical fact. He did not believe that whether something was true or not depended upon or was relative to the point of view from which it was seen. He believed certainly that the arts of history and of biography, and he was vehement that both were arts, consisted not only in the discovery of facts but also, and more crucially, in the interpretation of them. But he regarded the two processes, discovery and interpretation, as quite separate from each other. He did not think that the discovery of facts was inseparable from the interpretation of them, that all discovery and observation was, so to speak, theory-laden. On the contrary, an unexamined assumption that the discovery of facts is separable from their interpretation lies at the very centre of Strachey's thinking about historical and biographical methodology. It is what allows him, for example, to criticise Victorian historians and biographies for presenting facts without the point of view required for understanding. See, for example, his remarks about, quote, the late Professor Samuel Gardner in his essay on Macaulay. The most delicate and humane of all the branches of the art of writing, as Strachey called biography, does not consist in accumulating uninterpreted facts, but neither is it, as Dunn came close to saying, a branch of fiction. The biographer's task is to lay bare the facts of the case as he understands them. The point of view required of a good biographer is a way of understanding the facts, a way of seeing the biographical subject. It is not a theory any more than the change of aspect that allows us to see the ambiguous duck-rabbit figure, first as a duck and then as a rabbit, is the result of a change of theory. Neither is it, as Dunn puts it, a fictive thing. And yet, after Strachey, the subsequent history of the literature on biography is a tale of these twin misunderstandings of what a point of view is. How much longer shall I go on for?
I'd like to say for as long as you like, but roughly 10 minutes.
So what, 15 minutes?
Something like that.
Can you stand another 15 minutes of the season? Okay. Only 15 minutes. Okay. All right. Strachey's new biography has had surprisingly little impact on the way biographies are written today. Very few biographers now aspire to the literary panache that Strachey brought to his work, and the virtue of brevity upon which he laid such stress is one that, by and large, biographers no longer cultivate. It has had, and continues to have, however, a deep influence on the way biography is discussed. though this influence has been exercised not chiefly through Strachey's own work, but rather through Virginia Woolf's reflections upon it. Rather strangely, however, though Woolf never mentions Donne and shows no sign of having ever read English biography, the theme that dominates her two essays on biography, The New Biography, 1927, and The Art of Biography, 1939, is that raised by Donne, but generally ignored by Strachey, namely, the allegedly perilously shadowy line that separates fact from fiction in biography. What Woolf describes as characteristic of the new biography is not either of the two duties identified by Strachey, brevity and independence of spirit. Neither is it the importance Strachey attaches to a point of view. The trait she identifies as characteristic of the new biography is, rather, a leaning towards fiction. Her essay, The New Biography, is ostensibly a review of Harold Nicholson's book, Some People, an idiosyncratic collection of memoirs, most of which, as Nicholson makes clear to his readers, combine fact with fiction. Her second essay, The Art of Biography, is an appraisal of Strachey's work in which she applauds Strachey's Queen Victoria because it confines itself to documented fact and is content to be the work of a craft rather than art, while criticising his Elizabeth and Essex for aspiring to raise biography to an art and in the process combining, as Nicholson had combined, fact and fiction. In both cases, she is guilty of misrepresentation. Some People is indeed largely fiction, but precisely because of that, as well as for other reasons, it is hardly representative of the new biography. Elizabeth and Essex, on the other hand, is representative of Strachey's new kind of biography, but it does not combine fact with fiction, at least not in the way that Nicholson's book does, and neither quite in the way that Woolf suggests. There are passages in Elizabeth and Essex that are perhaps best described as fiction, but unlike the memoirs in Some People, their fictional elements are not acknowledged candidly as such by their author, but are rather presented as history. Where Elizabeth and Essex differs most strikingly from Queen Victoria, much in my opinion to its detriment, is in its appeal to Freudian psychoanalysis as an explanatory framework. Its flaws are due, not as Woolf would have it, to Strachey's determination to make biography into an art, but rather to his doing what Sidney Lee had warned against, namely making biography the handmaiden of a particular science, or in this case, a supposed science, psychoanalysis. Virginia Woolf's two essays on biography have replaced Dr. Johnson's essays as the two most heavily discussed contributions to the literature on the subject, and her misrepresentation of the new biography has had a deep and lasting influence on several generations of commentators on the genre. In particular, her essays have succeeded in placing at the very centre of the discussion of biography the issue of its relation to fiction, an issue to which, inevitably, Virginia Woolf brought her own distinctive views on the nature of fiction itself. I'm going to skip all that. What I then discuss is Virginia Woolf's views on fiction, which I say she then applied to biography. I then have a discussion of biographies written as if they were theories by, I'm thinking of Freud's Leonardo, Sartre's Flaubert. And then right at the end, and then I have a discussion of theories of biography. In which I argue against the postmodernist claims that that biography should be theoretical and that all biographies are fiction. And then finally, I have this section. I'll read some of this. I can talk, if you'd like me to say something about these missing sections on Freud and Sartre. And on theories of biography, postmodernist theories of biography, I'd be happy to do so in the discussion period. Right, let me try then to conclude this. Russell, when he was asked to review Husserl, said it's much like swallowing a whale. that's what this is like, I think. The theoretical term that this is my attempt at a conclusion. The theoretical term that I've been tracing has its origin in the widespread dissatisfaction with the way biography was practiced in the Victorian age. The uncritical and enlightening, fact-filled, two-volume works pilloried by Gross, Donne, Strachey and Woolf were evidently not fulfilling the aims of the genre as those aims had been understood from the time of Boswell and Johnson. The solution seemed clear. as Strachey saw very clearly what was required to turn, say, Thomas More's collection of facts into a biography, something that enabled us to understand Byron, was a point of view, a way of seeing the facts he had collected so that they arranged themselves into a coherent portrait. The notion of a point of view, however, has proved elusive. Indeed, the various manifestations of the theoretical term might be seen as a series of misunderstandings about what a point of view is. Nicholson, Freud, Sartre and Edel taking it to be a theory, and Dunn, Wolf, Nadel, Denzel and Eakin taking it to involve the fiction-making process. A more satisfying understanding of the notion, one that frees it from both theory and fiction, can be obtained by linking it with what Wittgenstein described as the understanding that consists in seeing connections. What produces this kind of understanding, Wittgenstein says, is a perspicuous representation. Something that he often mentioned as illustrating the notion of a perspicuous representation was a Galtonian composite photograph, in which, for example, pictures of several members of the same family might be superimposed on top of one another, allowing one to see the connections and differences between them, to see that these two have the same nose, these three the same eyes, and so on. Wittgenstein's language games were intended to facilitate the same kind of understanding. Once we see the connection between our language and the language game of Builder A and his assistant B, for example, we might become freed from the Augustinian picture of language, which sees all words as names of objects. The word picture is key here. It is a word Wittgenstein uses often and with great care to distinguish a pre-philosophical way of looking at, for example, language, from a philosophical idea, thesis or theory. In the very first paragraph of Philosophical Investigations, after quoting St. Augustine's account of how he learned to speak, Wittgenstein writes, "These words, it seems to me, give us a particular picture of the essence of human language. It is this: the individual words in language name objects, sentences are combinations of such names. In this picture of language, we find the roots of the following idea. Every word has a meaning. This meaning is correlated with the word. It is the object for which it stands." End of quotation. By beginning with St. Augustine's account of how he learned to speak, which Augustine offers as straightforward autobiography rather than as philosophical reflection, Wittgenstein announces straight away the target of his philosophical investigations. They are directed, that is, not at the ideas, the theses, or the theories of philosophers, which he just assumes are irredeemable nonsense, but at the pre-philosophical pictures which lie at the root of such confusions. Wittgenstein's aim was not to argue against the views of this or that philosopher, but to change the way we, where we means something like we human beings rather than we philosophers, look at language, mathematics and ourselves. Broadly speaking, there are three pre-philosophical pictures that form the target of Wittgenstein's work. The Augustinian picture of language, what one might call the Hardian picture of mathematics, and a picture of the human mind that might be called the Woolvine picture, so closely does it match that which one finds expressed in the novel, short stories and essays of Virginia Woolf. Much of Philosophical Investigations, in fact, is taken up with an attempt to dislodge precisely the picture of the mind that forms the starting point for the theorising about biography with which we have been dealing. In one important respect, the picture of the mind that forms Wittgenstein's target can be found in the literature on biography at its very conception. "By conjecture only," Johnson had written, "can one man judge of another's motives or sentiments," thus giving voice to a view that not only forms a central part of Virginia Woolf's thinking about the impossibility of achieving in biography the truthful transmission of personality that Sidney Lee had described as its aim, but also lies at the heart of the various views which insist that when we purport to describe what another person is feeling or thinking, we must, necessarily, be writing fiction. In Philosophical Investigations, Wittgenstein deals head-on with this view. Quote, "In what sense are my sensations private? Well, only I can know whether I'm really in pain. Another person can only surmise it. In one way this is wrong, in another nonsense. If we're using the word to know as it is normally used, and how else are we to use it, then other people very often know that I'm in pain. Yes, but all the same, not with the same certainty with which I know it myself. It can't be said of me at all, except perhaps as a joke, that I know I'm in pain. What is it supposed to mean? Except perhaps I am in pain." That's paragraph 246. "Are we perhaps over hasty," he asks a few paragraphs later, "in our assumption that the smile of an unweaned infant is not a pretense? Is it, we might ask Dr. Johnson, a conjecture that the baby is happy? Just try, in a real case," Wittgenstein challenges us, "to doubt someone else's fear of pain." Johnson's talk of conjecture, like Virginia Woolf's conviction that lacking access to the inside of another's head, we cannot really understand them, is founded on too rigid a separation between the internal and the external. In our ordinary language, these two are not so separate. Think of the recognition of facial expressions, Wittgenstein urges us, or of the description of facial expressions, which does not consist in giving the measurements of the face. When we when we describe what a person's face looks like, its external appearance, we very often do so by attributing to that person an inner state. His face radiated with happiness, her face looked anxious and fearful, a sense of triumph was written all over his face, and so on. It seems paradoxical to us that we should make such a medley, Wittgenstein remarks, mixing physical states and states of consciousness up together in a single report. Why do we find it paradoxical? Because we want to say that the sentence deals with both tangibles and intangibles at once. But does it worry you if I say these three struts give the building stability? Are three and stability tangible? That's paragraph 421. As André Maurer noted, a great sculptor like Rodin can turn granite into something expressive of the intangible, rainbow-like qualities of the personality. But once we remember the simple facts to which Wittgenstein draws our attention, we can see that it does not require a great artist to do this. Each of us combines the granite and the rainbow, the external and the internal, on a daily basis. Far from being impossible, it's the most ordinary thing in the world. Wittgenstein's strategy here is a good example of how he seeks to achieve his aim of philosophical clarity through getting us to see things differently, rather than, say, by getting us to assent to the truth of a proposition or a set of propositions, a theory, on the basis of an argument. When Johnson speaks of the necessity of conjecture and Virginia Woolf of the impossibility of getting inside another person's mind, they're clearly not thinking of the kind of examples discussed by Wittgenstein. They're thinking of the kind of case where we are, for example, sitting opposite someone on a train, to use an example that crops up with obsessive frequency in Virginia Woolf's work, and wondering what they are thinking. Wittgenstein is not denying that such cases exist, nor does his oft-quoted slogan, "an inner process stands in need of outward criteria, imply that there must be outward manifestations of everybody's thinking at every moment of the day. There must be criteria, public criteria, for the correct use of words describing inner states, but it does not follow that we can settle on every occasion whether someone is or is not in such and such a state. Let me see if I can find my last paragraph. Freud, Sartre and Edel present us with a set of propositions, a theory, rather than a point of view. And one consequence of this is that when reading Freud on Leonardo, or Sartre on Baudelaire, or Flaubert, it is Freud and Sartre we feel we've understood better, rather than Leonardo, Baudelaire, or Flaubert. Nadel, Denzin, and Ekin, on the other hand, have been seduced by the thought that because no single point of view either does or can possibly enable us to see the whole truth, the very distinction between truth and falsehood, fact and fiction, has to be abandoned. If, in contrast to these theorists, we see biography as an exemplar of Wittgenstein's notion of the understanding that consists in seeing connections, we will, I think, be in a position to see not just biography, but also Wittgenstein's later philosophy in a clearer light. Thank you.